In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
Is a battle of the Midwestern vice presidential candidates, or is it? From SDPB, it's Wednesday, August 7th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the Dakota political junkies consider the candidacy of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. And we'll explore why our Republican leaders say he's more California than Minnesota. We'll also discuss the latest financial scandal involving a massive loss of South Dakota taxpayer dollars. Later in the hour, we'll check out the White Ribbon Showcase at the Ipso Gallery in Sioux Falls. Plus, we'll meet the next Sinew Fund project leaders. Dwayne Wilcox and Brian Parker join us. But first, it has been a wild 24 hours in Minnesota state politics. Star Tribune reporter Christopher Vondracek is following the trail. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A Midwestern governor will appear on the presidential ballot in the vice presidential slot. Democratic candidate Kamala Harris has chosen Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as her running mate. Christopher Vondracek is an agriculture reporter with the Star Tribune in Minnesota, and he has spent years reporting in South Dakota and Minnesota. He's joining us now on the phone to talk about the past 24 hours of some wild Minnesota political news. Christopher, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Laura. It's great to connect.
So when did it start becoming clear in Minnesota that you're aware of that he was going to be this election? What were the signs?
You know, I think I kind of a bit of a political sort of enthusiast in terms of a lot of the coverage that I read in terms of, like, you know, political playbook and seeing what the talking heads are up to. And so I think over the weekend I was with my parents, and they were sort of I think they were like 24 hours off on the news cycle because we were walking our daughter Rosie, and she was like, my mom was like, oh, I think that Walz is like a second tier candidate. And I think this was after, I think, David Hogg, the gun safety advocate down in Florida, had started to promote Walz, and there was something happening kind of in the Twitter universe that was very much from kind of the progressive left side of the political spectrum that was really getting behind the Walz candidacy in the Veep Stakes. And so he ended up, on Monday I was talking to our political team because I'm at FarmFest, which is like a big kind of like hootenanny for the farm industry in Minnesota. And I was planning out stories, and I was like, I think we should probably do a story about Walz, you know, if he gets this nod. And the political team was kind of already on it, and they were like, yeah, I think it's, you know, pretty good chance he's going to get this. And in terms of the internal Slack messaging of the paper, people were talking about flights leaving St. Paul for Pennsylvania, where the rally was last night. So I think sometime in the last 48 hours, but I still didn't quite understand like how big a response it would be. Because I remember speaking with one of our editors who was like, well, you know, we don't want to have your story get lost if there's if there's three or four other Walz stories. And then sure enough, like Tuesday morning when it was clear that it was going to be Walz, and there was a big cavalcade of Secret Service vans and cars, et cetera, outside of East Cliff, where Walz has been living, that in St. Paul, that like we needed 30 stories, not three stories, because a lot of Americans were like, who's Tim Walz? How do we even say his name?
Yeah, right. I think I've been saying it wrong too. Walz? Like W-A-L-Z, everyone. Yeah.
Right. And I have seen some people make use of like the metaphor of like waltz. I think the Hill's Midday Report had something about waltzing on in or whatever. So anyway, but yeah, that's certainly a Midwestern governor with roots, you know, straddling South Dakota,
yeah.
In Minnesota and Nebraska.
Yeah. An educator. He's taught in Pine Ridge.
Yes.
He's a veteran of the National Guard, retired sergeant major. Food policy in the ag industry, that's a big deal. When I'm asking people, like, what is the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear this man's name? And for me, it was the school children hugging him when he said they could have free lunch.
Is it? Yeah, it's so true. And I feel like, because as you know, like, I had been covering politics in South Dakota previously to coming to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And so I think What's interesting is I have been doing a lot of reporting in Minnesota on the closure of a hog plant in Windham, and its immigrant workforce and where did it go. And so a photojournalist named Liz Flores and I went down to Mexico to track the workers and everything. And it wasn't until like a week ago when that photograph of walls being surrounded by children after the signing of the bill, which is usually a pretty like nonplussed kind of encounter, but it was kind of organic in this instance, that that Liz had actually shot that photo. That's now like being shared on the BBC's page or whatever, you know? And so I was like, oh my gosh, do we get like credit for that? Or does that boost our clicks or what? So anyway, yeah, that I think is kind of how he, you know, whether speaking to my family across the country or friends or, you know, whatever, like I think he kind of came a little bit more into the national conversation around kind of opening up school lunches. Yeah.
All right. So, and then to that end, with the price tag for that, Senator Thune, Governor Noem, everybody are saying like he's more California than he is Minnesota, which I find so fascinating that the first thing they try to take away from him is his Midwestern identity.
Yes.
What does that bring up for you? Like, this is, we should be like thrilled that there's a Midwesterner, even if you don't like his politics, but nope, we're going to say he's really more California. What's going on there?
I could put on like a sort of different hat than ag reporter. I mean, I do think that it's interesting to see what sticks in terms of the conversation around politics, around like what is a Midwestern identity versus what is sort of a coastal identity. That certainly got brought up in the debate around Shapiro versus Walls. And I think that what's interesting to me, first off, is that like Walls, to say nothing of the policies, even people who don't like him in Minnesota, admit that the guy likes to drive his motorcycle and he hunts pheasants and he wears Carhartt and he talks like a Culver's dad or a Dairy Queen dad or whatever. Like, you know, like, and like does the football coach stuff. Like, he sort of like has this kind of like Midwestern sort of like authenticity about him. And so I don't know if that's, I don't know if trying to place, like that's the one thing that I think is really, really defensible for him, right? Like you can't, I think the line was from Ken Martin, who's a Democratic strategist or the party chair in Minnesota. He said something the other day, like you can't out small town Tim Walz. And like, I don't know, that sort of seems like a challenge for me as a kid from a small town.
Right.
But at the same time, right? But it's, and like, what does it mean to be from a small town? It can mean a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a quality to which, yes, he was the Gay Straight Alliance director or faculty representative at Mankato West High School, like in the late 90s or something, but he was also a football coach. And so he kind of coalesces sometimes identities that in rural America don't seem like they maybe belong together. But he kind of does that in a way that sort of excites people, at least on the political left and maybe in the political middle as well.
Sure. All right. What happens next in Minnesota as he, because that was always a big question mark in South Dakota, that Kristi Noem was criticized for really, you know, being too many places other than South Dakota when she was a hopeful. Well, now he's the actual pick. What happens with Minnesota state politics?
That is a great question. I actually don't even know in terms of like, you know, this morning I wanted to confirm the detail about him being a teacher in Pine Ridge. And so I reached out to Claire, one of his spokespeople, and she responded. But I was like, I don't even know if like, you know, does he have new staff? Like, how do we get a hold of him? And, you know, and I'm sure like today he's in Eau Claire and we have a small army of journalists from the paper, I think, going over there into Wisconsin. We had some people in Pennsylvania on the ground. But as far as the governance day to day, it does bring up an interesting question is if things would go in their direction, the Harris-Walz ticket, and he would be elected, then Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan would be the governor of Minnesota by state law. And she would be the first, the state's first governor, female governor, and then would also be the first Native woman as governor of a U.S. state.
Wow. So do you now, as reporters, are you elbowing against the national media in a way that, because, I mean, I would make the argument that nobody is better positioned to do this coverage than you and your team and the other, you know, broadcasters and newspapers, reporters across the state of Minnesota. But I also know from experience that they're not going to call you and ask you. They're just going to elbow out. So what happens next with your coverage?
So what's interesting is like the kind of questions that have trickled down to me on the sort of ag beat, and I'm kind of like on a journalistic island a little bit because we're obviously like based in the cities, but I kind of like have rural Minnesota as my landscape. And I've had questions from editors, like apparently the New York Times referred to Minnesota as an agrarian state.
Okay.
And one of our data people was like, is that true? And I was like, look it up, 50 million acres, 25 million of them are cropland, you know, like fourth biggest trade export, you know, in the country is Minnesota for ag products. But it's like, so it's interesting in some respect. I think the national coverage also allows locals to see in greater relief what is happening or what our state is about or something.
Yeah.
And so that is always, I mean, and I think as a journalist, and you know this, I've had conversations with like SDPB's Lee Strubinger about this, about like when like a national media shows up to say Mitchell and they refer to it as windswept, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And you're like, and you kind of are like, gosh, not again. Right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you're like, if you ever stood in downtown Mitchell, right. And it's like, it's kind of windswept, right? Even in downtown, right?
It's hard to not like, notice it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And like, yeah, maybe it's like a lazy descriptor or whatever. I mean, I'd probably opt for like the Corn Palace or whatever, you know, but to me, there's kind of an excitement for us as journalists to also sort of check our own coverage, our own maybe blind spots, et cetera.
Yeah.
But as far as, yeah, I mean, like I think last November, Biden spoke at a pig farm in outside of Northfield, and I was standing next to a New York Times reporter who shall go unnamed, who she referred to it as a barn, and I was like, this is a machine shed. Like you need to refer to this as a machine shed in your coverage, and she did, and I was like, this saves you at least three letters. So, yeah, I think it's healthy both ways. You know, we both can learn from each other, the sort of national press and the local press.
Who took the photo of Governor Tim Walz holding the piglet? Because that's another one that's going to be everywhere, right? Yeah, I'll have to look up the byline for that. The credit,
I know, and
photo
his
credit.
Turkey event. Like his his turkey event. And I was just on a hayride with him visiting a farm a couple of weeks ago. And people are kind of sharing all these stories about like, you know, Walz behind the scenes or whatever. And like, I went through the video that I had shot and there's literally a clip I have of him talking about his love of the smell of hay bales.
Okay.
So, if it's an act, if this is like a rural persona he's put on, he's wearing it like 99% of the time, seemingly, at least in public. So.
Well, we are definitely going to be checking in with you about Farm Fest and your governor and all kinds of things in the future. Chris Bondrajek, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Laura. I appreciate it.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, for months, Governor Kristi Noem was on the short list as a vice presidential hopeful for Donald Trump before her star faded and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance got the nod. Now another Midwestern governor takes the spotlight. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz joins the Democratic ticket with Vice President Kamala Harris. Our Dakota political junkies are here with analysis on that and some other topics. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. He's a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. John Hunter, welcome back to the SDPB Kirby Family Studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the invitation.
And joining us from the Black Hills, Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen. He is co-host of the weekly political podcast, Dakota Town Hall, and he's president of the Home Slice Group there in the Black Hills. Murdoch is seated in our Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Welcome.
Thank you so much. The studio is so cool, by the way. I love it. This is maybe the nicest studio in the Black Hills. I should be saying that. We have studios.
It's a lovely place. Thank you to the donors of South Dakota Public Broadcasting for these beautiful studios in which we sit right now. All right, let's start with Governor Tim Walz. I'm not sure if you were all listening there to Christopher Bondrajek, which, you know, brings up, John, you know, the idea of what might have been if the nod had gone to Governor Kristi Noem and all of the reporting would have been scooped up by the national news. And there's something sort of thrilling and unsettling about that at the same time. Any precedent for this kind of attention so close to the border here on the east side of the state?
No, I don't see a precedent for that. But you know, Midwest, we've talked about this in the past, especially that book came out not long ago about what is Midwest, who identifies as Midwest. And so It's apparently has a good reputation nationwide. And so I think if Governor Noem and Governor Waltz had both been on the ticket, they would have tried to out Midwest each other. Who's more Midwest? And they'd wear farm clothes and they'd wear ranch clothes and they would do everything they could to prove they are Midwesterners.
I had to go back and check the numbers. Murdoch, I don't know if you've been part of these conversations. West River, as much as we are East River, but J.D. Vance from Ohio, of course, is Ohio in the Midwest. And the survey of Midwestern identity by Middle West Review and John Locke's group says a lot of people in Ohio consider themselves Midwesterners. West River, South Dakota, do you consider Ohio Midwestern? Is this a battle of the Midwestern VPs?
Sitting in the Black Hills, I mean, this is unique to us, but it's funny you bring it up that way. We're constantly in these fun bar napkin debates of where, if we're in the Midwest. I think we're the Mountain West out here. So Ohio can, I guess, have the Midwest.
You're in with Colorado, I guess.
Yeah, you know, we're mini Colorado Springs, if you think about Rapid City.
There's a lot of Colorado people who say they're in the Midwest, too. You got to check out the Middle West Review. It is the largest ever study on Midwestern history. And we talk about it maybe to death, Murdoch. So you'll enjoy catching up with that data.
Very good.
However, to this point, Governor Kristi Noem, Brad, has turned around and said, he's terribly radical, which is what we would expect to hear. Anything else out of the responses from John Thune's office, from the governor's office here in South Dakota, that indicate what this battle is going to be like? Because I don't think, even though Kristi Noem is not going to be the candidate, that she's not going to be a proxy right here on the western border of Minnesota, shouting South Dakota loud and proud. That was for you, Murdoch.
I thought that was to John. It's my first time. I'm trying to listen and do a good job.
Can't you see us pointing at you?
Well, I think Walls was the perfect candidate to try to out Midwest, I guess is the phrase. I also saw he's not afraid to start taking hard shots right away, which I think that's something the Democrats, I think, have sorely needed.
Yeah. Speaking of that, let's talk about your time in Sturgis. Have they printed the new t-shirts yet?
It's been kind of the joke. The Sturgis motorcycle rally, we were honestly a little scared it was going to be the first national event where the t-shirt printers were going to maybe not have an editor or two. But so far, so good. It's the normal, the Sturgis rally audience is certainly a Trump audience. The t-shirts are what you expect.
All right. Well, if you haven't been there, I mean, the last time I was at Sturgis, Hillary Clinton was on the t-shirts on the back of a lot of motorcycles. They were very misogynistic t-shirts. And then there were also a lot of, freedom and, images of Donald Trump looking like Rambo or a warrior. So tell us, in an FCC-friendly way, are they putting Kamala on the back of a bike in the same way? Because I'm very curious to see if that was a Hillary-unique thing or if that was a gender-unique thing. How is she showing up?
I mean, certainly a little of both. It's a little early, so it's not Harris everywhere.
Didn't know about it, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
right?
That's a surprise. If
this would have been maybe a couple weeks down the road, I guess. I'm not trying to make the Sturgis rally attendees look bad, but some of the shirts they wear do make them look bad.
Well, and it's not always what's selling, but it's maybe what's for sale. Some of those end up in a box and going home, and they're novelty items,
And you could see that in 2016, the Confederate flag t-shirts kind of got popular, and then maybe they took them home and got yelled at by their family, and they stayed in a box. So you don't see those as much, which is nice.
I was trying to figure out the difference between a t-shirt that people are going to buy and the t-shirt that gets you in the store.
Sure, the one they hang on the wall to get you to walk in. You know, the Sturgis rally has always been a very politically free group. This is my 24th Sturgis rally this year. It used to be more of a keep Austin weird, mm-hmm. It was really odd, everyone welcome, you do you, mind your business, weird. And now it has a weird militant tinge to it, which, that'll burn out like everything else.
Yeah. Which brings me to the race this week, right? And that's going to be on Fox.
It's Fox Television. There, yeah. It's so the rally, the second weekend of the rally needed a boost, and now there's this thing where, you know, the Sturgis Rally going back to the 1930s has a wonderful history of motorcycle riding and races. And now that this event is going to be on the second Sunday, similar to how NASCAR does Chicago or F1 does Las Vegas, they go right through downtown. And so they'll be like the New York Yankees of the motorcycle racing world speeding through downtown Sturgis on the second Sunday. It's so exciting.
Yeah. So, John Hunter, if you're advising Governor Kristi Noem and you know this national audience is going to be watching this race, is this an opportunity for her to be in the spotlight? And if so, what should she take that opportunity to do?
I wonder if there is an opportunity there. I think people who would tune in to watch those races would be interested in the races themselves, that they would not be interested in a political debate there. Now, that being said, there is an audience, and in a close election, every audience counts, every vote counts. And so anytime I think you can get your message to more people, they would try to do that. Now, I don't know if the organizers of the races or anyone else would carve out time to take a look at a governor as part of that or not. But
sure.
I think in both campaigns probably want to reach every possible audience they can.
Murdoch, has she been out to the rally this year? I haven't seen that yet.
Governor Noem was out yesterday. There was a big military appreciation day. There's a lot of veterans and service members. And so she came out to do sand on the rally point and give some proclamations, which was great. You know, I've always kind of been hard on our administrations for not, you know, trying to get the most out of the Sturgis Motorcycle. It's the largest event we have in the state. It generates hundreds of millions of dollars in economic benefit all through the state on the interstate corridors. And so I like that even though sometimes they're not my favorite governors, I still like that they come out and try to support the rally.
Yeah. John, speaking of military, the vice president's two military veterans, Tim Walz, National Guard, J.D. Vance, U.S. Marine, former. Walz has a longer career, of course, but that's interesting too. It's been a minute since we had that.
Well, I think what's really interesting is if you look back we had enough wars in time that it used to be all candidates had military veterans, especially post-World War II. You know, presidential candidates, vice president. I mean, if you look, Nixon, Carter, Ford,
your
all of them.
Commander in chief.
All
yeah,
of them,
that's
right.
Supposed
and
to
so
be, yeah.
It really wasn't, I think, till Clinton until you had a new president without military experience. So I often thought it was, and I remember telling my dad this, I said, I think that if you are going to be commander in chief, I think it's valuable to have been in the military itself. Mm-hmm. And obviously, presidents have other responsibilities, but certainly foreign policy and military leadership are key elements. So, I do find it interesting, but the pool doesn't have as many military veterans as it used to.
Yeah. I want to pivot a little bit. We can go back to this in a minute if you gentlemen want to, but I do want to make sure that we take it home to a column that John wrote in the Madison Daily Leader recently that is talking about the latest state financial scandal. And this is the indictment of Lana Carroll, who is a former DSS employee, former state employee, for embezzling, allegedly, a whole lot of money, $1.8 million. John, this is not the first time we have sat and talked about financial scandal and oversight. How does this fit into, maybe we should spin people up who are new to it, but in the last 10 years, we have seen a number of taxpayer dollars not end up where they were intended to go, and not always with justice or punishment, for some interesting reasons that we'll unpack here. So set us up, please.
Well, those are a lot of great, you triggered a lot of thoughts already,
yeah.
But yes, it is. Now, let's get right out of the way. These are, it's alleged crimes, right? Innocent until proven guilty. But you're right, this would be the third kind of major state scandal, millions of dollars involved. You remember the things we talked about before, the EB-5 visa scandal, and then the Mid-Central Education Co-op, which was associated with the Gear Up program. They were a little bit different. They were not employees of, they are not state employees of South Dakota. Those were programs set up, they had used federal dollars, or in the case of the EB-5 thing. It was actually investor dollars, foreign investors coming to South Dakota and bringing money with them and then people siphoning those off. So they are very different in those three situations. The one with Lana Carroll really disturbs me because that is, it appeared to be over such a great length of time and not having been caught for that long, if true. But to take $1.78 million over 13 years, presumably 13 audits and multiple supervisors and other people who would be interested in this, really worries me because that would indicate if you've got, I don't know, 12 or 13,000 state employees, are there other opportunities for this if that can go on that many times? You asked me to fill in this thing. So Lana Carroll worked for the Department of Social Services in the Child Protection Services area, and that money is intended to help families to, you know, in reporting child abuse and neglect, connecting parents to resources, involved helping a little bit with foster
kids,
foster and other working with parenting skills and all that. So by anyone's stretch, those are great causes. And we talked a little bit. I talked to Josh Chilson, who, by the way, at SDPB, who has done some great reporting on that. We talked earlier, is this a theft of South Dakotans? You and I didn't pay any more taxes because of what this allegedly happened. But the state appropriates that money each year to this program. And I would presume there are always more requests than money available. And so who was it stolen from? People who made requests and didn't get the money for whatever. Right. And I'm presuming they're good purposes. So that's even a bigger tragedy with this. But I have deep concerns that this may... Is this an isolated case? Only one person stole from state government out of 12,000 employees over the last 13 years? I doubt it's an isolated case.
Yeah. Murdoch, three governors, multiple department heads or secretary heads. So it's really hard to pin this on any one leader, but also Attorney General Marty Jackley has definitely been the person who more than once has been charged with cleaning these problems up. What else stands out to you in this particular case, Murdoch?
The thing that stands out to me in this case is, as John was saying, where the money's being taken from is the biggest step. I don't know why this isn't a larger conversation in every statewide election. It's almost insane that it's not, and it certainly should be in 2026 as 17 people are going to be running for governor.
But Murdoch, you're exactly right. That is, it should be part of that debate, and who's going to be able to address that best?
And I don't think anybody can, like, you know, Marty specifically, I don't think has an angle to say he has been cleaning it up because these things keep happening. I don't mean to be hard on our attorney
general. He doesn't make the policy. He's been
right. He's the police officer. Yeah. He's not the
right.
Policy.
Yeah.
And I would have said that. I would have said Marty Jackley is the one who you're gonna, because he's gonna be able to come out and said I've fixed other people's problems. But anybody who's been affiliated with the Rounds administration or the Noem administration is gonna struggle because somebody else could make a case out of that.
And maybe. It's a shame sometimes the opposition for this argument comes out of, you know, the most kind of conspiracy-minded on Facebook. And it'd be nice if the Chamber of Commerce Republicans punched into this debate a little.
All right. We're going to leave it there for now. Murdoch, thank you so much for joining us. John Hunter, thanks as well. We'll have more on this conversation in the weeks ahead.
Thanks, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This Friday, August 9th, from 6 to 8 Central Time, you can attend the White Ribbon Showcase at IPSO Gallery. Now, White Ribbon is a community-submitted artwork which is specialized by category with custom ribbons awarded based on criteria. So to explain that maybe a little bit better than I can, we have Liz Heron, Gallery Director for the IPSO Gallery, and Cody Henricks, one of the artists exhibiting in the showcase. Liz, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for bringing me on.
Cody, thanks for coming back to South Dakota as well.
I love it.
Thanks. Former curator of the Visual Arts Center at the Washington Pavilion. We've talked to you many times, but also a renowned artist. So Liz, tell us a little bit about White Ribbon, because I love this idea.
Well, I think we all have experienced like the Fair Arts Expo, and it has a completely different feel from walking into a more pristine white wall gallery space. And we wanted to capture kind of the fun, the hominess, the craft component that goes into an arts expo at the fair.
Sure.
And bring it into the gallery space. But we also wanted to distinguish our space and that show as different from the fair by making pretty whimsical categories. In fact, one is mystical, and I think that's what you submitted, right?
Yeah. I want to talk about that in a minute. But first, for people who are listening across the state, this is a good time to remind them that this is an art gallery that's in a business.
It is.
This is not an independent art gallery. This is a community business who decided we have space to put in some art, and that can be replicated throughout the state and is often largely in coffee houses
right. And
places like that. But why is that mission important, and where do those two things intersect between business and art gallery?
Well, I feel like there's many ways to answer that question. One of the biggest and most selfish answers to that question is that it stimulates us as creative people to continue to think differently, to evolve in our creative process, to consider a different approach to how we're solving a creative problem. Art that faces you or surrounds you every day and operates differently than you do creatively just challenges you. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most selfish reason we have the gallery. But the bigger purpose is that this is a space for artists. It's not a retail space. It's not the idea behind it isn't to make money in order to continue to represent and make sales in that space. The idea is to be very creative with the types of shows that we can offer. And so that's what we've been trying to do for the last 10 years.
Yeah. So, Cody, how do you approach a challenge, or really maybe a better word is an invitation like this one?
So I have been showing, just it's like a brief background. So I've been showing for the last 20 years everywhere from New York to Oregon, right? So and one of the best parts about an IPSO show is the prompt. So Liz, as a curator, and then the staff that work at Fresh Produce, they build this really thoughtful and engaging way for an artist to explore maybe new directions, new ideas, new concepts. And so prompt-wise, you know, and for the listeners who maybe aren't thinking about what even a prompt is, yeah. It's like as an artist, I might have a track I want to make on, and I'm just making, thinking about my own thoughts. And suddenly Liz is like a thorn jabbing in there saying, have you thought about the county fair? And then I say, no, I don't think about the... But then suddenly I am, and I'm thinking about my practice through the lens of this maybe peculiar or folk experience of the fair. And I've done a number of shows
a
with
lot.
IPSO now.
Yeah.
Okay, which fair? The South Dakota State Fair?
Oh,
or,
well,
or...
we know the allegiance where my allegiance lies. No, I think that all fairs are wonderful. I should, in full transparency...
Very, very diplomatic
yeah,
answer.
Yeah, in full transparency, I should tell you that I just judged the Rock County Fair Arts Competition.
Okay.
So
yeah.
The bar is high for IPSO. And in addition, my daughter, who is 10 years old, has a piece in this show. And she first submitted it to a fair.
Wow.
Yeah.
She has two pieces.
Two pieces, yeah. The Puking Cloud. And
which I just won the challenge. I got all nine pieces.
Oh.
So, which is, it's under the category of midway or game.
Yes.
And she made a game out of this ceramic cloud piece. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
So what other categories did you come up with, Liz?
Well, on the spot, I hope I can remember most of them. One is ribbon dancer. We only had one submission to that category. Collections, assemblages, mystical and elemental. Sensory is another one. And what am I missing?
I think you're close. Earth?
Oh, 4-H.
Oh,
just
4-H.
The embodiment of 4-H.
Right.
It's food and homecraft.
Animal husbandry.
And we have a submission to animal husbandry.
Yes.
It's amazing.
What about mystical sparked your imagination as an artist,
Cody? So I'm by trade, that's sort of what I'm most interested in. I'm interested in myth and mysticism in my personal practice. So it's a really natural migration. for many, many years, I've had a studio rule, which is defy gravity. And so the piece that I have in the show for this one is a gentle sort of gesture. It's like the Adam's gesture in the creation of Adam by Michelangelo. But he's holding a rock, right? So it's a human, it's my arm. It's a human arm.
Sculptural.
Sculptural is yep. human arm holding a boulder that's sort of disproportionately large and impossible. And that's what you're greeted by.
And it's kind of totem-esque. It's like
it's a bit of a totem, yeah.
Yeah, it's got a really beautiful part of the sculpture, like pedestal that, you know, segues to pieces that go up to the top, but it's all parts are relevant.
Yep.
I think one of the last times I was in the gallery and one of your pieces was there, what I remember is, you know, wanting to lie down on the floor and look at it from that angle, wanting to elevate myself to look at it from that angle, going all around it and circling it and listening. And it was multisensory, and it just invited you into a much deeper space. I know that you give that process up somewhat when you submit the art, that, you know, my experience isn't necessarily what's keeping you up at night. However, what do you hope that gallery goers experience when they go to this exhibit and especially interact with your art?
My hope is always a very simple set of circumstances for the viewer, which is, one, I want my artwork to ask you a question. Let me back up. I want you to look at it. I want you to look first. I want you to be visually stimulated on some level so that you want to engage. Then I want the work to ask you a question. And if it does those first two things and you want to look again, then I think I've created something successful. In an IPSO show, what I'm really most excited about is this opportunity to share what has been my life's passion and my best way to communicate with my daughter, who is so much like me. And so this process of communicating through visual creation, I think, is super powerful. And so much so that we recognize it at a fair level. We recognize it at a coffee shop level, right? It's like, it's very human of us.
They're trying to bring it back into the Olympics.
And we should.
What?
The art.
Art?
Art.
Olympic art?
I will be the first
It used to
Olympian.
Be a part of the Olympics in the past. Yeah,
how
there
so?
Was an artistic component. I don't know the history of it entirely, but there's a push to bring it back. Let's do a show about that.
We're going to leave this here for now. So Liz, leave people with the details about the exhibit and the opening.
Okay. Well, it will run from this Friday, which is the
August 9th.
9th, yeah.
Yep.
With a reception from 6 to 8 p.m. until the very end of September, the last Friday of September. We'll be taking that down.
All right. We'll put more information up on our website as well. But thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
See you next time. Check in now with another of the projects awarded a Sinew Fund grant. Dwayne Wilcox and Brian Parker are organizers of the Warriors Vietnam War Era Project, which is funded by the Sinew Fund with Racing Magpie. And Dwayne and Brian are seated now in the Black Hill Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City to make the connection. Dwayne Wilcox, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a big fan of your work. By the way, just side note, I'm thrilled to talk to you.
That's nice to hear.
And Brian Parker, I'm just delighted to get to know you as well. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Let's start with how the two of you have met and decided to work on this project together, which is really about documenting real-life experiences in the Vietnam War era. Dwayne, kick us off, and then we'll bring Brian into the conversation, too.
Yeah, when I had this idea, I thought of Brian, because Brian being a veteran also, I'm a veteran, but I didn't serve any combat theater. Brian did. So I remember growing up, I met a lot of these guys before they even went to Vietnam. They were in high school. So I'm at that age where I was in between everything. So my focus was kind of to talk to some of these veterans from that served 65 to 75. That time era was a whole different place in America. You had the draft still going on. The political environment was a lot different than it is today. And I think it was poignant to kind of bring Brian in on this because I have no film experience at all. So Brian was the first person I knew immediately that could have an understanding at least where this went. And he had the expertise that I would need to. We could collaborate and have this to come about. I think it's a difficult era, I guess, for people to understand now because of the way this country is now. So I thought it would be important to kind of talk to some of these veterans because a lot of them were boarding school era. Their outlets of media about the world and its political views was limited. You know, a lot of them probably didn't even read a daily newspaper, let alone a radio or a television news organization before they even got to the Army. But they knew that their father served, and that was something that they was always proud of. So that's what they followed probably by their heart. I always thought it was going to be very interesting for this generation to see the differences that they had to face.
Yeah. Brian, tell me a little bit about your experience as a filmmaker and how that has it intersected before with your military service, or is this the first time you're putting those two aspects of yourself together?
When I first became really passionate about filmmaking and storytelling in that medium was when I was in Iraq, 2004 to 2005. I was with the 1st Cavalry Division, and one of the things that I had purchased before I was deployed was a little Sony Handycam, a handheld camera, and I was just really interested in documenting as much as I could while I was overseas. I figured, you know, that was never going to happen again in my life, and you know, I just needed to have these stories captured in some way. And so that kind of led me to art school. Once I was honorably discharged, I went to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and was one of the first of three students who participated in their new filmmaking degree course.
Wow.
And so... yeah, and from there, it just kind of started building a little bit, my interest in storytelling, and just meeting a bunch of artists, and that's where I met my wife and moved back here to Rapid City with her, and just through the art scene is where I met Dwayne, and just, you know, we kind of bonded over both being veterans and having that kind of shared experience, even though we're veterans in different times and different branches, you know, we all relate to those hardships and things that we went through. And I lost my father 2 years ago, and he was a veteran. He was a Vietnam veteran, 1st Marine Division. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I regret now is never asking him more about his experience in Vietnam, but also my whole life I kind of stayed away from that because I didn't want him to kind of relive those moments.
Yeah.
Because I knew, like, they were, you know, the things that kept him awake at night. And so, you know, kind of regretting not asking him more about that or capturing that for historical archives, it was almost serendipitous the way that Dwayne approached me and was like, hey, would you like to work on this project with me? And I was like, okay, here's my chance.
Yeah.
I now get to honor those warriors that are still with us and those that have gone before us in this way. And I'm just very... honored to be able to work with Dwayne on something like this.
Yeah, unfinished business. And yet Dwayne, so many of these, you know, my father's a Vietnam veteran. He's no longer with us. He passed away in 2014 at the age of 68. they're, you know, we're losing these people, and we're losing them. Many of them are passing away or dying earlier than you might expect because of some of the exposures that they had. So this gives a sense of urgency to this project as well. What does that bring up for you?
I guess the original reason that I thought this was going to be something that's to answer some of the questions is I remember this is how this first came about, the thought process of getting this out there is a different time and everything. I'm going to go off script a little bit about the image that kind of set on my girlfriend at the time, now my wife of 42 years. There's this little black and white 3x5 picture that was sitting there of a man, and it's fatigued standing. You can't see the background, just the it's a boy basically. Mm-hmm. And it took me years to actually find out more about his story. He died in 1968 in Vietnam after being there for 6 months. This is her older brother, who went to Syracuse University on a full scholarship for wrestling. And after he was in school for a year, he was scoffing at all of the kids that had these doctors that would write them flat feet, bone spurs, neck, back issues and things to get out of going into the military. He dropped out of college and joined the Army. He ended up dying 6 days after his 21st birthday. And the sad story is his mother, who was English and was during World War II, met my wife's father. Those two were both in that that theater of their life, and then to have a son go deal with this other portion over here in America. Yeah. But anyway, the sad part of that story was my mother-in-law was interviewed by her local newspaper talking about the day she received they came to her house to tell her of his KIA situation, I guess, and then they printed in the paper that like on a Wednesday, this was like on a Friday that they told her, but when it was printed, the next morning she got out and she opened the door to get the paper, and someone had painted baby killer on the door. And this was a different time in America, right? Now we're all screaming patriot, you know, different time altogether. So that kind of stewed on me for years, and that picture still is in our house, and it sits there, and it's a brother-in-law that I never met. And that's kind of a poignant part, you know, like Brian talked about his dad. My dad was a Korean War vet, and he didn't really talk about, you know, like him. I would have liked to ask him a lot more stuff, but he died at 53, so I didn't really mature enough to get to the point where we could have that, you know, relationship of my time in service and his time in service.
I want to jump in here because I want to make sure that our listeners know this is called the Warriors Vietnam War Era Project. It's funded by the Sinew Fund. We've been talking about that all week with Racing Magpie, and you've met many of the artists and people who are working on these projects. And Dwayne Wilcox and Brian Parker, we would love to talk to you again, follow up on some of these projects. Brian, audio excerpts of the video on the radio are always welcome. So be in touch with us as you move forward on this. We're running up on the end of the show, but hopefully this isn't our last conversation. So thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh, and we thank you for listening.